This episode of Voyager is sponsored by Midcoast Advisors, client-driven advisors devoted to helping you reach your financial destination. Visit their website at midcoastadvisors.com.
Tim Dalrymple, welcome to the podcast, man.
It's great to be here with you, Travis. I'm glad we could finally make it happen.
I am too. Even though it's virtual, I can see you and you can see me, but we're doing this via audio and that's okay. But hey, just real quick, what are you up to these days? I mean, I would guess a lot of people know who you are. I would guess some people don't know who you are, but we can dive into that later. But what are you up to these days? And this is beginning of May 2022, by the way.
Yeah. So all of this could change. I could lose my job. Everything could change about my life right in between now and when this airs. But if this is the answer to the question you're asking, I'm the CEO and the editor in chief of Christianity Today. And that absorbs a huge amount of my time. And then I am an obsessive soccer dad.
That's right.
I have three girls who are 13, 10, and 7. The 7-year-old is not yet playing soccer, but I'm with the 13 and 10-year-old usually for 3 or 4 games every weekend. And that's a lot of fun. And then I am the husband of the great Joyce Dalrymple, who is a wildly talented woman who impacts all sorts of women through her ministry, and she is also the world's best mom.
Of course, and I was going to ask you, where are you spending most of your creative talents these days? But I'm guessing it's on the soccer field or sitting on the sidelines of the soccer field, which, and we went through that era.
It's giving my children excellent advice on how to run routes, how to switch their coverage, all those sorts of things. Because I, as someone who never played soccer, at least after the age of 7, am an expert on these things.
Of course you are. And you've got the coach on speed dial, right?
Oh,
not that anybody has speed dial anymore, right?
Yeah, if speed dial were a thing. Oh, I text advice from time to time. And I'm sure
coaches love
they
that.
So love getting advice from a gymnast on how to run a soccer club.
Speaking of being a gymnast, talk a little bit about you talked about your family briefly, but tell folks a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up? Where did you go to school? And you did some things while you were in school. Talk about any of that.
Sure. So I started out in Northern California. I was raised in and around the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. I was, a rising star in the worlds of baseball and soccer at the ages of 5, 6, and 7.
Of course.
And then we moved, and we were late for soccer signups, and my parents needed some way, some outlet for my energies. And the 1984 Olympics had just been on television. And I had watched the men's gymnastics team win the gold medal.
So do you actually recall watching that? Do you recall watching it?
Oh, I do. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I do. And I didn't really fully appreciate this at the time, but this was a year that was boycotted by the Soviets and a number of other kind of Eastern Bloc nations, which is the entire reason why the Americans did well in gymnastics. But I didn't realize that. I just thought, great, we're the best gymnasts in the world. This looks fun. So I was doing a lot of flips around the house. My parents decided I should either I needed to get some training or I was going to, die in some horrendous gymnastics accident against the recliner.
Of course.
And so they took me to a gym, and gymnastics became a huge part of my early life. And I was raised in a loving Christian family. And so gymnastics was also a huge, it was a laboratory of faith for me. It was a place where I saw the faithfulness of God in times of victory, in times of defeat. And I think gymnastics, for better or worse, shaped my character in profound ways.
What year was the last routine you did?
So that would have been 1996.
Okay, because you were gearing up potentially for the Olympics, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was a junior national champion, and won multiple all-around event and team national titles as a junior. And then I went to Stanford University, which had arguably the top gymnastics program at the time, still does, or does again today. And my freshman year, we won the NCAA title. And then it was my sophomore year that I did my very last routine.
And that was a memorable one.
Well, yes. So technically, my last routine I competed, I had a broken neck at that time. So I'll tell you, the competition was, it was not a very important competition, thankfully. It was a dual meet early in the NCAA season against San Jose State, which was just a little to the south of where we are at Stanford. And so we went down, and during warmups for the competition, to make a long story short, the bar was loose and I did not adjust properly. I was doing a triple backflip dismount from the high bar and opened up out of my tuck, landed not on my head, but not on my back, you know, somewhere in between, partway on the mat, partway off the mat, and broke my neck. But I didn't know it was broken. I never lost mobility or sensation. And I thought, all right, well, first thing I need to do is get back up on the high bar, because you don't want that fear to fester. So I continued warmups on high bar and then floor, and then competition started, and I competed on the pommel horse. And that...
with a broken neck.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... So I usually win the competition when it comes to, you know, who has done sports while injured. That I competed with a broken neck, and that's, you know, something I'm proud of. And then it was still a day and a half, 2 days before I went into the hospital and discovered that actually... Because the pain did swiftly become very severe.
Right.
And discovered that my neck was badly broken. And it was a miracle that I was not rendered a quadriplegic.
Wow. Wow. What an incredible story. And that was all 1996. So no Olympics for you that year.
Yeah, that was so that was in February. I believe the Olympic trials were in June for a late summer Olympics. And I had a good chance. I wasn't a shoe-in. I would have been the youngest person on the team.
Right.
The stars seemed to be aligning until that moment when the stars suddenly went awry.
Oh, man. We could spend an entire podcast just talking about your gymnastics career, your short gymnastics career. Yeah, I mean, you were an incredible athlete, but I want to walk through... we're going to get into some how-to stuff here in just a little bit, just because you're incredibly creative. I mean, that's why, one of the reasons, I mean, you're a friend, but also wanted you to come on the podcast. But talk a little bit of just, you know, your career, the trajectory of your career is quite interesting. And I know gymnastics was a part of that. I mean, eventually you go on to get your PhD. I know you got an MDiv at Princeton, you get your PhD at Harvard. Just walk through, what were you thinking? So post-injury, that part of your life is kind of coming to an end. What's going on there? What are you thinking going forward?
What was I thinking is a question I ask myself frequently when I look back on the history of my life, which is, I think the kind word is eclectic. So gymnastics, again, was fantastic. I don't regret it. If I had to do it over again, I would do it over again. But it paid for my education at Stanford, which I never could have afforded otherwise. Mm. And then you find that if you do a relatively decent job at a well-respected university, you can kind of parlay that into further degrees. I believed that God's call in my life was to be a winsome and articulate, persuasive Christian voice within the secular university. And my field was philosophy of religion, which can be in a philosophy department or in a religious studies department. And so I went about getting the degrees that I would need in order to teach at a secular university in that topic.
So that was your plan?
That was the plan. And I was always engaged in Christian ministry as well. And so I went and got an MDiv at Princeton Theological Seminary, where there were professors that I wanted to work with in that area. And the training in ministry was also relevant and helpful. I wasn't, you know, that is a part of an MDiv degree that differentiates it from some other master's degrees in the area. And in my field, you usually got, kind of you went somewhere and you got a master's and then you went into the PhD program as opposed to getting the master's along the way to a PhD program. So I, as I wrapped up at Princeton, I applied to Harvard's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and their PhD program in the study of religion. And then I went there and I still remember. I don't think I've mentioned this ever on any podcast, but I remember when I got the call saying that I had been admitted to Harvard, which was where I wanted to go. I was driving down the Las Vegas Strip with a friend. We were actually on our way out to a gymnastics team reunion, and I had flown into Las Vegas, and we jumped in a car together, and we were going to drive out there. But he drove me down the Strip that night, so I could see all the lights, and I got this call, and it was just kind of this deliriously happy moment.
Oh, wow.
So I went on to Harvard and spent 7 lovely years there.
Yeah, you studied Kierkegaard, right?
I did, yes.
So what was your dissertation? What was the thesis?
My dissertation was on how Kierkegaard understood the varieties of human sufferings and the various roles that they play in preparing us for faith or in the life of faith.
Okay.
So I fell in love with Kierkegaard at an early age. My brother went off to college before me. He's 3 years older. Came back one summer and handed me this book that was selections from the writings of Kierkegaard. And I consumed that and then studied Kierkegaard during my undergraduate years, wrote 2 master's theses on Kierkegaard at Princeton Seminary. So I was relatively well prepared. I knew exactly what I wanted to write on. And because of my experience with a broken neck and also the chronic pain that came as a result of that, I had a really keen interest in ways in which we make sense of suffering. And again, kind of, I had found that my own experiences of suffering deeply, deeply shaped my faith in ways that I think on the whole were positive. So I was interested in how others reckoned with sufferings in their own lives. And Kierkegaard was somebody who definitely wrestled with a deep and persistent melancholy, perhaps depression, certainly anxiety seems to have been a constant theme for him, some physical ailments that were either related one way or the other. And he developed this very sophisticated sort of grammar of suffering or typology of different sufferings. And the ways in which they showed us that we're being something less than we were meant to be until we get to the life of faith where you suffer just because you're being persecuted.
Well, you know, thinking about your, and I do want to talk about your career a little bit more, but when you look back at the gymnastics thing, your studies, you're studying Kierkegaard, dealing with suffering yourself, what has surprised you about the track you chose, even as it plays into your career, just the trajectory of your career, and what makes perfect sense? So what surprises you as you think back and what seems to make, okay, that makes complete sense why all of this took place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it has definitely been the case that there are many times in my career where I went from doing one thing in one field to doing something completely different in another field that I never would have anticipated.
Right. And more than once, right?
Yeah. So just to get to the first transition there, well, we've mentioned going from a career in gymnastics to a career in academia, and that was a relatively long career. And I loved teaching. I loved the research and the writing. And yet, when I got to the end of that, as I was wrapping up my dissertation, wrapping up my PhD program, suddenly I was no longer persuaded that that was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And there was a group of other individuals associated with my institution who were launching a religion website called Pathios, and it had not gone live yet. But they asked if I would be interested in being the managing editor of the Evangelical Channel. And so I said, that sounded really interesting to me. I thought that would be a side gig. So I began to do that to make a little extra money in addition to what I was making teaching. And what I quickly found was that I just loved it. And so I ended up transitioning from academia into media and a startup business that was producing this religion website called Pathos that was a reproduction online of the marketplace of religious ideas. And the hope was to elevate that marketplace, to elevate the conversation on life's most important questions, to make it more informed, more charitable. Whether we actually succeeded at that, I don't know. That was the goal. And so I found myself taking really all of my prior experiences, as well as kind of parts of my personality that really weren't being expressed in academia, and weaving those together into something totally new. Or I should say, they were woven together. It was not kind of pre-planned by me, but they were woven together into something new. That took all of the academic training, but also my sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And suddenly I found myself doing something that felt even better than what I had planned.
When you began to question things as you were wrapping up your dissertation and just kind of unsure, did that scare you? Or was it just kind of, it'll get figured out? What were you thinking?
I'd say it was both frightening and exhilarating. One virtue of the academic track is that it's very well defined. Mm-hmm. So you go, you get your degrees, then you go onto the job market, you take a position. Hopefully it's a tenure track position and you work toward tenure. In theory, you know what the qualifications are for receiving tenure. Then you get tenure and you may move around a little bit, but essentially the tracks are laid out in front of you. And you know, now that can be appealing. At that particular point in my life, I found it a little dreadful. I found it a little constricting. So that's the exhilarating part, was that suddenly it seemed possible to take kind of the sum total of my experiences and expertise, such as it was, and personality, and find different ways of giving that expression that might support my family, but also, you know, enable me, Lord, hopefully, to have a positive impact on the world.
What was the mission of Pathos? I mean, you've explained it a little bit, but what was the mission again, and who were you really hoping to connect with? Like, who were you thinking would actually use this?
Yeah, the mission, so the original vision for Pathos was to be a sort of WebMD of religion.
Okay.
There was not a dominant player in the religion space online. There was for...
And this is what year? What year was this?
2008 was when I first got engaged.
Okay.
And so, you know, if you wanted to learn more about... If you wanted to participate in political conversation, there were certain websites. If you wanted to learn about sports or keep up with sports, there were well-known websites. There really was not in the faith space, even though a lot of people said that they wanted to go online to consume content about their faith. Mm-hmm. So WebMD of religion, a sort of trusted advisor, a trusted source of information. But we also wanted for there to be a lot of kind of cross-pollination or at least conversation between people of different faiths. So it was built on a library of encyclopedic information about different religious traditions. Mm-hmm. And it had a fairly sophisticated mechanism for comparing different religious traditions and what they taught on different things. It also had something called a public square, where you'd take a different topic every week or every other week and invite all of the traditions to say, hey, you know, what are your thoughts on the meaning of life or raising children, right? And then there were different channels for different religious traditions. And what we quickly found was that people mostly wanted to stay within their own religious tradition. That was kind of what they were after. So now why I got involved, I really believed that, you know, it connected with my faith personally. I was not thrilled with what I saw as evangelical Christian voices in the public marketplace of ideas. I wanted to be a part of crafting that voice. And I believed that, you know, the truth eventually wins out. And of course, I could be wrong about what the truth is, but I believed that, you know, it was an open marketplace of religious ideas. I think what became apparent very quickly was that with the way that media, the blogosphere, social media were shaping the marketplace, that it was anything but sort of an open and free marketplace of ideas.
Hmm. What of the platform still remains today? I mean, I haven't looked at Pathos in a long time. What is still there today that you guys had put, you know, all this work into, you'd built it out, and what is completely different? Or are there things that are just completely different today? I mean, we're talking a long time, obviously, but...
Well, so we ran very quickly into the limitations of the business model of media when it came to online content. So this is, like I said, 2008, 2009, we launch, and everybody's wrestling with what is the business model. We're building audiences online. They don't seem to want to pay for access to content. In particular at that time, I think today people are more understanding that yes, if we want to support high quality work, that we should subscribe. But back then it was really kind of advertising was your main source of revenue.
Okay.
And what we found that worked was essentially building communities of blogs. We couldn't afford to pay somebody, you know, $500 for an article that we didn't know if it was going to reach 100 people or 100,000 people. And more often than not, it was 100 people, especially in the early going. And the economics of that are just prohibitive. So eventually you need to get to where you have, and this was the structure at the time, where you have one person who comes back multiple times per month, who visits multiple pages each time that they visit and sees multiple ad impressions on each page. And you kind of multiply those up. For every one person, you have 20 ad impressions to sell or something like that. But the best way that we could do it was by recruiting bloggers who already had their own followings and then compensating them by the traffic that they generated. So you would be paid, if we knew that we could make $4 per thousand page views, for instance, then we could afford to pay a blogger $3 per thousand page views.
So at some point, I mean, you had a lot of people that were going to the site. I remember you talking with me about this years ago, but I want to say at one point it was the most visited religious website or religious website of its type. And how many hits were you getting on a regular basis?
Yeah, we had about, I think at the peak, it was 30 million page views a month.
Okay.
And we were the largest religion website on the planet, as far as we know, and as far as the rankings went. There may have been some like Mormon.com that would have been larger, but it wasn't clear that they were in the same category.
Okay. What did you once tell me? There was something on there something to offend anyone.
Yeah.
How did you word that?
Yeah, it was if it was a marketplace of ideas, it was kind of a Wild West marketplace, I'd say.
And, okay.
And what I told you was that there was something there to offend everybody. So, you know, we had evangelical Christian and mainline Protestant and Catholic channels, Mormon, Jews, Jewish channels, a lot of the things that you would expect, Muslim, et cetera. We also had some that were, we had a pagan channel. We had eventually kind of an atheist channel. And so it was certainly a really remarkable platform for the exchange of ideas. But again, I think, gosh, as we have seen today, the way in which social media in particular, but not only social media, kind of the broader digital media landscape really has fragmented audiences and driven toward these very, very finely targeted sort of micro communities. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing that in 2011, 2012, 2013 before I left.
Yeah, and you did leave eventually. So let's talk about your next endeavor. Again, you're just kind of going from thing to thing, which is incredible, which is why your story is so Interesting. So you end up going to or creating Polymath. So how did you, I want you to talk a little bit about what Polymath was at the time that you founded it, but what were you trying to do? How did you land in that space into creative design?
Yeah. You know, I was a part of a Bible study at a church called Perimeter Church. I think you're familiar.
I am.
And in that Bible study, there were several other men who had started their own businesses. And I had never imagined myself starting my own business. I don't know why. I just, my vision was to be a writer and thinker. And and so I just, business seemed in some way profane and also just not something that I ever envisioned for myself. But to hear them talk about it, it demystified the process a bit. And I thought, well, you know, if they can do it, why couldn't I do it? At the same time, I had begun to do consulting for a number of organizations I really admired that needed help coming into the 21st century. And they saw that what we were doing with developing a web platform and an audience and creative content, that something was working. And they wanted to figure out what it looked like for them. So I began to do that. And pretty soon I had more work than I could manage. I also had friends who were saying, hey, I'd like to get your thoughts, but then I'd also like to build a website or develop a slide deck or do an animation. And so I began initially with no financial connection involved. Initially, I just began to connect people and say, hey, here's my friend who will give you a terrific website. But eventually I had someone who said, I don't want to pay this guy that I've never met up in Canada. I'd rather pay you and then you supervise his work. You know me, you know what I'm looking for. And that's when I thought, okay, maybe I should start a business to serve as a corporate entity for that. So Polymath began with an emphasis in those areas that I had some claim, however plausible, some claim to credibility. And so it began with content development, it began with web strategy, but then as is often the case when you have a small business and people ask, hey, do you also do this? The answer was always,
yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, then you kind of figured out how to do it or who to pull on board because we did know other creatives. And when demand for their services became sufficient, then we just added them permanently to the team.
Okay.
And so we grew Polymath into a full-service creative agency in that way.
Midcoast Advisors founder Derek Isensee has a passion for helping people make wise financial decisions.
My name is Derek Isensee. I am one of the owners of Midcoast Advisors. We're located in Northwest Indiana, serving the Chicagoland area and beyond. And we are a full-service financial services firm offering wealth, investment, financial planning, tax, insurance, and estate planning services. We are a one-stop shop for all things finance. My specific role within the organization is heading up the CPA firm portion where we serve clients across the board, individuals and businesses.
He believes that financial freedom is possible for everyone.
I joined Midcoast Advisors to join a team and help our clients meet one simple objective, and that's helping them figure out the right things to do with their money. And so our goal for each one of our clients is for them to find financial freedom. We do that through a variety of different services, which all fall under the umbrella of kind of our guide, guard, give approach to planning. And so we guide you through kind of a financial planning process, guard against the villains that could come and mess up your plan, and then ultimately get you in a place where you can give and steward your resources out of a place of freedom. Each one of our professionals here at Midcoast really feed into that process to meet clients' goals and objectives.
Reach out to Derek and his team to see how they can help you reach your financial goals.
Anyone hoping to connect with us at Midcoast Advisors can find us at midcoastadvisors.com. Click on the contact tab, fill out your personal information, and someone from our team will reach out to you.
How long before you actually hired your first W-2 employee? Going back to, you know, you have the concept, you think, okay, I think I want to do this. You start responding to asks. And how long did it take before you're actually hiring people?
Yeah, that's a good question because the first people that I worked with were in Canada. And so I had one wildly talented young man who had reached out to me when I was at Pathios and helped to develop some of our social media offerings. And then he was kind of one of the people that I would say, hey, this guy can build your website. So, but he was not going to be a W-2 employee. He was a contractor. And even though we worked together a lot, and then when we needed somebody who could do graphic design or who could do animation, then he always knew people. And so some of our first teammates were Canadians. And but it was probably less than a year or a year and a half before we began to kind of build up the team, including some American W-2 employees.
Did it surprise you at any time? Like, okay, I'm actually doing this. Did you think, how in the world am I doing this?
Yeah. So it surprised me in that I had never envisioned starting my own business. It also, I had only really been a part of one business prior to this. Mm-hmm. I had only ever had one CEO, and then suddenly I'm a CEO.
Right.
So that was different. But again, it was an experience of, okay, all of the threads of my life, they kind of have been woven together in a new way, and yet it feels great. It feels even better than what it was before, because now it wasn't just helping to build this web platform, which, you know, got into kind of my entrepreneurial side, my expertise in religion, but now it really incorporated my love for writing, my love for storytelling, my love for media development. And I had always been a leader of sorts in my athletic endeavors, in church, in ministry. And so here I had an opportunity to apply some of that. And certainly I learned a lot along the way about what it means to be a leader of a creative team.
Yeah. Can you talk briefly about how did you, because you led a distributed team. You already mentioned that some of the early talent, some of the people that you worked with, they were Canadians. And I know that you kept building this thing and it was distributed. You had people everywhere from Austin to the Northeast, to the upper Midwest, to the Southeast, to Atlanta. How did you build the team? How did you find talent? Was it all through relational networks or some other way?
Well, being open to remote teammates definitely allowed us to hire the best talent that we could afford, mm-hmm. and that we could find. And that was, there were also people on the team who wanted to live in more remote areas. They understood they might make a little bit less than if they lived in New York or Toronto, but so they were willing to work for a little bit less in exchange for that sort of freedom. So we were able to afford people that were better than we might otherwise be able to afford. Mm-hmm. So we did end up, I, at this point in the story, I was living in Atlanta, and we did end up with a sort of critical mass in Atlanta, seven employees or so, seven teammates. And so we would meet at a remote, at sort of a shared workspace called Rome, that I still love, once a week, sometimes twice a week, depending on what we were working on, and the rest of our employees were distributed. And so it grew very organically. It was always demand driven. Right. It was never the case that we just kind of said, well, here are all the skills we need. We're going to hire all these positions and then find the work. It was that we had the work and we had to find the right people to do it. So essentially, you know, I could have given you a business plan at certain points, but that really would have been mere invention. It grew organically. Because our plan was quality. It was to be good to our clients and deliver fantastic work. And then as you build those relationships, then that grows and the things that they look to you for grow. And so that's not to say that there weren't some projects where we, you know, I'd say underperformed, or some client relationships, especially in the early going, that didn't go sour. You have, you know, 100, 200 client relationships, you will have some of those stories, but most of them went well. And that was kind of what drove the success and the growth of the business.
So at some point, CT comes along, Christianity Today comes along. How many years had you been involved with Polymath before CT came knocking at your door?
So I spent 6 years or so at Polymath, from when we launched it to when I moved on to CT. So it was probably about 5.5 years is when I first began to hear from CT about filling this position.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened? And did you even see anything like that happening coming along? Or was it a complete surprise?
No, that was not the plan.
Of course.
I loved what I was doing at Polymath. I just led this wonderful team of creatives who were and are talented, have excellent integrity and passion, enthusiasm for their work. And we got along well, and we worked for clients that we loved and did projects that were interesting. And so we were working for, you know, international NGOs and big ministries and small ministries, big companies and small companies, foundations and think tanks and museums. And my only thought really was, you know, let's get this to the place where it can largely run itself, and then I can devote myself full time to writing while sitting, you know, by a lake in the mountains.
Of course. And by the way, we forgot to mention at one point you already had at least one book that you had worked on, but if we have time, we can talk about that later, but keep going.
Yeah. So Christianity Today had been a client. It was a very small engagement, mostly a consulting engagement earlier. And I was familiar, especially through my Pathos time, I was familiar with the leadership at Christianity Today. But the executive search firm reaches out and says, hey, we're looking to fill this position. Some folks have mentioned your name. Are you willing to kind of throw your hat in the ring? Hmm. And I said, no, I couldn't imagine leaving my business, couldn't imagine leaving my team. I couldn't imagine my wife leaving Atlanta, which is where she had grown up. And I didn't have a compelling vision for the future of this ministry. I felt like if it was going to succeed, that it needed fairly transformative change. But it has such a remarkable legacy. Sometimes it can be difficult for organizations institutions with remarkable legacies to exercise the kind of entrepreneurialism that might be needed in a rapidly shifting environment. They pushed back on that point, and they felt like the board recognized the need for disruption. And so they said, are you 100% no or 99% no? And I said, I'll pray about it, but 99% no. They said, great, wow. Until you're 100% no, just stay in the process. And it was minimal. It was very easy to stay in the process. So I agreed. And a couple months passed, and I continued to reflect on whether this was something that I should pursue, and decided again, no. But I at least wanted to have an idea that I could share, that I could step out of the process, but nonetheless feel like I had contributed something for their time and investment. So I began to think and pray on what might an idea be that would be compelling. And you mentioned Kierkegaard earlier. Kierkegaard talks about a time in his life when he goes off in search of an idea worth living and dying for. And for some reason, that kind of came back to me, and I was asking myself what would be a vision worth living and dying for this really storied ministry. And so it was September 28th of 2018, and I was getting ready for bed. The rest of the family was in bed. And this question came back to mind, and what I heard in that moment, in a way that I would have regarded with skepticism if it hadn't happened to me, was, my bride is beautiful, she needs a storyteller. And I was overwhelmed with a sense of the depth and passion and profundity of God's love for the church. Overwhelmed also with a sense of grief and brokenheartedness, that the story of the church often is not told very well. Where there are stories of falls from grace and hypocrisy and intolerance, the world rushes in to tell those stories. But for every one of those, there are hundreds of stories of men and women who are striving to follow the call of Jesus Christ in ways that are redemptive and beautiful and unimpeachably good. Hmm. And those stories too often aren't told. So that felt to me not like an idea to share, but it felt like a vision to live and die for. It felt like something I was being called to. So I spent the rest of my night typing into my phone ideas for what it might look like for CT to be a storyteller of the global church and what I might be able to do with my business. Woke up the next morning, Saturday morning, dreading talking with my wife about this. And we hadn't talked about it for 2 months ever since I had gotten that first call. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea she was even reflecting on it at all. But before I could say anything to her, totally unprompted by me, she turned to me and said, "You know, I've been praying about it. And I think you should pursue the CT job. And if God calls us to go, then we need to be willing to go."
Wow.
And that's really what changed the trajectory of my life yet again and took me into the position I now occupy.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that could be a podcast in and of itself. You're CEO today. Are there, an executive search firm reached out to you. Are there some things that you were doing you think that gave a hint to others, okay, this might be someone we might want to consider as a CEO? What do you think stood out with your work, with your endeavors, with how you were spending your time, how you were making your decisions? What stood out to you with the whole CEO thing of an entity like this? I mean, you already were a CEO, but it was a company that you had started. This was something, completely different in so many ways, even though I know you'd consulted with them a little bit, but can you talk about any of that?
Well, I think that the very eclecticism of my experiences was actually a strength in this situation.
Okay.
So I had have some degree of academic credibility that comes from degrees. With that, a grounding in the history of the church, the theology of the church, biblical interpretation, mm-hmm. but also just the broader religious landscape, understanding kind of religion in the modern era. In addition to that, experience in the media space, particularly the digital media space, where CT mm-hmm. had, I think, the most opportunity for growth. And then experience building a business and reconciling your finances and getting people paid and recruiting people into new projects. And so I wouldn't have clients here at CT, but a lot of the same skills that are involved in business development and recruiting clients are similar to what I have to do here on a regular basis. And that's, right. Develop a vision, develop an idea, communicate it well and invite people on board. And I became, through that experience, just really powerfully convicted of the potential impact of a ministry like Christianity Today. So I don't think there's a bigger believer in the mission of Christianity Today than I am. But I think it was really kind of the combination of those things. Plus, the board was really hoping for somebody who would experience a profound sense of call.
Okay.
That was, for me, the most profound experience of calling I've ever had.
If you could go back, there's so much more. I know we're limited on time, but if you could go back to your, let's say your freshman year at Stanford, you are an emerging star in the gymnastics world. You're a world-class athlete, better than most for sure, at least in gymnastics. What kind of conversation do you think you would have with yourself? Knowing what you know now, you're going back, you're 18 years old. What would you tell your 18-year-old self? What would that conversation look like?
Well, I do think people at that stage of life sometimes worry a little too much about finding the one path that they're going to take professionally. Hmm. Thinking, okay, I need to figure this out and... because whatever I pick, I'm going to be doing that for the rest of my life. And my story is ample evidence that that's not necessarily true.
Right.
That you're going to find ways in which your skills and talents and passions and training combine and recombine over time in ways that allow you to do meaningful work in the world while supporting your family and taking care of the people that you love. So I would have told that freshman that, you know, life is going to be an adventure. You don't know where it's going to lead. And, you know, I'm about to give a commencement speech. And I sometimes think about these three terms of tapestry, weaver, and storyteller. Hmm. And what I have found over the course of time is that my tapestry, you know, when you have a storytelling tapestry, you can see these. I was just at the Vatican Museum in Rome. And you have these tapestries that proceed over the course of multiple panels to tell a story in different chapters, essentially. And, you know, that my life has had multiple panels in the tapestry of my life. And I thought at the beginning that I was the weaver of the tapestry. I thought I was the one who was putting the story together. Hmm. It turns out that is not the case at all. That it has been woven together for me. And I'm not really the weaver of the tapestry. I'm simply the storyteller. I'm the person who kind of comes alongside all of these different panels that have been woven together and helps make some sense out of it and tell that story for other people. So maybe that's what I would have shared with 18-year-old me.
Wow. Tim, thank you for spending time out of your very extremely busy day on a Monday in early May. So thankful for you, for the work that you're doing, for your friendship. Miss you. Wish you lived here in Atlanta. Of course, you know, it's much warmer here in Atlanta. And I love taking pictures outside when it's like 72 degrees.
And sending them to
it's
me.
It's like 30 degrees up where you are.
Yeah, thank you. That's always encouraging.
I figured it would be. So I've got a few rapid fire questions. What are you currently reading?
So I have just started Andy Crouch's book, The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World. I'm excited about that. I'm not that far into it. I've gotten through the first chapter, but I've always enjoyed Andy Crouch's writing. And otherwise, you know, I like to read books that have I like to read narrative-driven books as a way of getting outside of my work life. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading a couple things right now that actually they're related to my work life, but they're narrative driven. And so I'm going on a little trip along the Danube this summer with some CT partners. And so I'm reading about the Habsburgs. Okay. One great book called Danubia, and it's about the Habsburg Empire.
Yeah, I'm guessing not everybody has that book on their shelf for the summer.
Oh, yeah. Surely everybody is devouring Danubia just like I am.
Favorite music? What are you listening to right now? Maybe I should say, what are you listening to? And then maybe what is your favorite music or music genre?
You know,
which is also quite eclectic, which is kind of why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, I appreciate a pretty wide range of music. I love classical and more contemporary classical works. I also, you know, if I had to pick one band that's like my life band, it would probably be U2, which I think is predictable for somebody my age. But there was something to kind of this the spiritual life and yearning for meaning and beauty that I find comes through in their work so much.
Are you still waking up super early, coming into the office before everyone? Because I know that's when you put on some tunes.
It depends.
Like 4:30 a.m.
I have stretches where I get up very early and come in before everybody else. And then I have stretches where my body tells me, you know, you need to get some sleep. And I'm relatively young for the job that I have, but I'm not nearly as young as I used to be. And, you know, sometimes you got to listen to your body.
No doubt, man. So last question. I think it's the last question. So what project are you working on right now that you're most excited about? Or maybe a project that you want to mention And that could be anything.
Yeah, we've got so much going on right now. So I'll just give a little bit of a pastiche. So we've got something called the Global Initiative, where we're dramatically expanding the global storytelling footprint of CT, obviously very consistent with kind of my own sense of calling, but also mm-hmm. consistent with Billy Graham's original vision and what my predecessor had been working toward. And so we're planting editors in different places and strategic cities around the world. And so going to those places and laying the relational groundwork and getting those people hired is an awful lot of fun. And we've also been just adding the capacity and personnel and budget and multimedia capacity to do kind of that global storytelling with terrific production value. I would say too, the things that we're doing that are connecting with younger audiences, whether that's podcasting, or we have a publication we acquired called Ecstasis that I love. And then the things that we're doing under what we call our Big Tent Initiative, that's about better representing the diversity of the North American church and reconstituting some semblance maybe of community and unity across all of our differences, ethnic and generational and political. And so things like bringing Russell Moore to lead our public theology project are all part of that effort.
Very cool. Tim, we're going to let you go. Thank you, brother, for taking time out of your day to be on the podcast.
Glad we could do this.
Voyager is brought to you by Core Media Source. Editing and mixing by Kevin Duthu. Recording and studio coordination by Beth Grabencourt. Songs used on Voyager include Like the Ocean by The Big Letdown and Could Be Anyone by Courses. All music provided by Epidemic Sound. Join us every Wednesday to journey through the lives and minds of creative visionaries, artists, and innovators who are changing the world with their work.